Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
The long-awaited trial of five 9/11 suspects is set to begin this year, not in a civilian Manhattan courtroom as originally proposed by President Obama, but at a military court in Guantanamo Bay. We'll get a unique take now on the meaning of those trials for today's world from journalist William Shawcross, who happens to be the son of the chief British prosecutor at the Nuremberg war crimes trials after World War II. His new book is called Justice and the Enemy, Nuremberg, 9/11, and the Trial of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. And its author, British journalist William Shawcross, does join me now. William, welcome to WNYC. Hello from New York.
Hello. It's wonderful to be with you. Thank you so much.
Can you tell us first about your father, Sir Hartley Shawcross? What exactly did he do at the Nazi war crimes trials?
Absolutely. He was the British Attorney General after the end of the Second World War in 1945. And as such, he was the chief British prosecutor at the Nuremberg War Crimes Tribunal. And this tribunal was set up basically by the United States with the collaboration of their democratic allies, the British and the French, and the enforced collaboration, if you like, or unhappy collaboration with the Soviet Union, our other ally, which in many ways was as guilty as just as terrible crimes as the Germans. But Truman and decided after he took office, after the tragic death of Roosevelt just before the end of the war, that there must be a trial. Stalin had wanted to execute 100,000 German officers. Churchill had thought that the top 10 people who we arrested from Hitler on down should probably just be shot up against a wall. But the Americans said, no, we must try and create a justice system, a proper tribunal. And so Nuremberg was created. And the real hero, I think, of the story and of my book is Justice Robert Jackson, whom Truman appointed Supreme Court Justice, to go to Europe in May 1945, as soon as the war ended, to create a tribunal. And Jackson did a fantastic job. He toured the wreckage of Europe. He found in Paris that the U.S. Army, the liberator of Europe, the principal liberator of Europe anyway, had amassed thousands and thousands of documents that the Germans had created and which they had noted or notated all their crimes. And Jackson was amazed that anyone could be so stupid as to put it all on paper. But there it was. And the trial began with Jackson, under Jackson's guidance and with my father working with him in November 1945. And it was over with amazing speed by July 1946. And of the 22 defendants, 12 were sentenced to death, seven were sentenced to long prison sentences, and the others were let go. So justice, I think, can be seen to have been done at Nuremberg, and it was a remarkable achievement in a very difficult conditions.
And for our listeners' benefit, here is a little bit of audio, about 30 seconds, of Justice Robert Jackson, the chief U.S. prosecutor, making his opening statement at the Nuremberg trials after World War II.
The privilege of opening the first trial in history for crimes against the peace of the world imposes a grave responsibility. The wrongs which we seek to condemn and punish have been so calculated, so malignant, and so devastating that civilization cannot tolerate their being ignored.
Wow, I have not heard that before, and it really gives me chills hearing Robert Jackson opening with the words that it's a privilege to be opening this first trial in history for crimes against the peace of the world, as they actually put people on trial for the Holocaust and the other crimes of World War II. So why do you use that as a backdrop to write about Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's trial today?
Well, partly because my publisher suggested it to me. He said when President Obama's Attorney General Eric Holder announced in 2009 that they were going to put, the U.S. administration was going to put Khalid Sheikh Mohammed on trial in Manhattan, and there was an immediate outcry in New York City and elsewhere saying these people came here once, we don't want them back again. My American publisher suggested to me, William, your father was the British prosecutor at Nuremberg. Why don't you write a short, sharp book saying Nuremberg was how we dealt with the monsters then. How should we deal with them today? And I loved my father and admired him and was very conscious throughout my childhood of Nuremberg and used to play the similar records to that which you've just played of Robert Jackson. I used to listen to my father's speeches at the prosecution. So it was very much informed my early life. And so I thought this would be an interesting idea. And so that's what I've tried to do, to look at the context of the trials of these monsters, evil thugs in Al-Qaeda today, in the context of how we dealt with the Nazis after 1945. And of course, it's much more complicated today. For one thing, the most important difference is that the war had ended in 1945 in total victory by the Allies. So they were putting on trial defeated representatives of the broken Nazi regime.
What's the relevance of that for how justice is carried out?
Well, it was a concluding chapter, and both Jackson and my father said the point of this trial is not only to bring justice but to establish, in my father's words, a touchstone and a record for future historians for which they will turn for truth and future politicians for warning. Now, in the case of Al-Qaeda, it's still an ongoing story, unfortunately. The principal core of Al-Qaeda has been defeated or killed, most recently or last spring. Bin Laden was killed, and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was the mastermind of 9/11, is in jail in Guantanamo and is now, as you said, about to be put on trial. But there's been a long debate within the United States since 9/11 and around the world over the best way to deal with these people. Should it be just the criminal justice system, or should it be a military justice system, which is a perfectly legitimate form of justice throughout American history? It's been used from time to time. Or should it be a combination? And in the end, I think the Obama administration has come to the right conclusion that there should be federal trials for some and military trials for those for whom those are more appropriate.
Do you see Nuremberg as more similar to a military trial or a civilian trial?
Well, it was a military tribunal. It was called the Military Tribunal, an international military tribunal at Nuremberg. It had, of course, civilian participants in it. Justice Jackson, in principle, and my father, and the French prosecutor were all civilian lawyers. So it was a hybrid, if you like. It was an ad hoc tribunal created for the particular circumstances of 1945, and I think it worked very, very well. There are some to whom it will always be victor's justice, but I think it was, in all these matters, it's a question of choice between of choices, and I think the right choice was made, certainly a better choice than Stalin's to kill 100,000 German officers, or even Churchill's to execute the top 10 German officials whom we captured.
Listeners, do you think the history of the Nuremberg trials informs the debate today over how to try Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and other terrorism suspects? Call up and talk to journalist William Shawcross, who was the son of the chief British prosecutor at Nuremberg. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. His new book is called Justice and the Enemy, Nuremberg, 9/11, and the Trial of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. Your position surprises some people who knew your work in another era. You were well known once upon a time for opposing the Vietnam War, but you supported the invasion of Iraq and basically support the Bush administration's approach to these terrorism suspects. What changed?
I think what changed was the many things, but in terms of Vietnam, was the appalling aftermath of the Vietnam War, the mass murder, genocide inflicted particularly in Cambodia after the United States was defeated in April 1975. About a million people were murdered in the the worst genocide probably since the Second World War, since the Nazis against the Jews. And in this situation today with Al-Qaeda, there's awful huge differences, of course, between the Nazis and Al-Qaeda, but they have a similar philosophy. They are both totalitarian, anti-Semitic, anti-Christian, nihilist, and cannot be appeased. The Nazis wanted to create a 1,000-year Reich. The Islamist terrorists want to create a universal caliphate in which Sharia law and they dominate the world. They are a very, very dangerous enemy, and I can quite understand why, after 9/11, that wicked mass murder committed by al-Qaeda and masterminded by Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the United States reacted very strongly. And the United States has certainly made mistakes in the war against terror, but it's also had successes. And I think in Europe in particular, there's been a lot of very unfair criticism and a refusal to understand the predicament which any U.S. administration, not just the Bush administration, would have faced after 9/11.
But the Europeans are in that predicament too, aren't they? London was attacked. Madrid was attacked. This is a domestic concern as well as just kind of gawking at the Americans, and yet the Europeans seem to come to different moral conclusions in many cases.
Well, I don't know if they come to different moral conclusions, but they have different ways of dealing with it, certainly. But the principal victim has been the United States, and they are the principal target of the horrible ideology expressed by bin Laden in particular. And I think that in Europe, the Guantanamo and the trial at Guantanamo is much criticized. One point I think is worth making, and it's important to make indeed, is that any Nazi who was transported by time machine from Nuremberg to the dock at Guantanamo would be astonished at the privileges that he is entitled to there. Anyone in Nuremberg, I think, as I said to you, it was a decent trial and the proper way of dealing with the situation in those days. Excuse me. But there was no right of appeal, for example. The judgment of the tribunal was final. In Guantanamo, by contrast, anyone convicted can appeal, and no doubt will appeal, all the way up through the federal system to the Supreme Court of the United States. And you don't get much better guarantee than that.
George in Bay Ridge, you're on WNYC with William Shawcross. Hello.
Thank you for taking my call. As I'm listening to this, I'm, going back to the justice that was meted out at Nuremberg, and I'm wondering what your father and the other justices would think of the program of waterboarding. I think Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was waterboarded, I believe it was 186 times, and should we be thinking about Mr. Addington and Cheney sharing a place at judgment over their treatment? I mean, when we stoop to their level, I mean, what does that say about us as people?
George, thank you very much. William Shawcross, I'm sure you've heard that question before.
Yeah, it's a very important question, and I've dealt with it in my book. I think nobody likes to read about or to let, still less to have the government's imposing a enhanced interrogation, as Watergate boarding was called. I think the important thing is that in a war against terror, justice has to take second place to begin with to intelligence. And after 9/11, Osama bin Laden had said our next step is to use weapons of mass destruction against the United States. The Bush administration decided in those circumstances and with that danger, they had to extract information. They waterboarded three people. The head of the British Secret Service, Eliza Manningham Buller, said, and others have said, this did indeed result in life-saving information being obtained from waterboarding. Nonetheless, it was wrong, and that is a position that is perfectly fair to take, that it was wrong. Others would say it was right to save human lives in that way by waterboarding three people. One thing that is interesting to me is that Bush has been attacked and excoriated around the world ever since for those enhanced interrogations. Obama has taken a very different attitude. No one is subjected to enhanced interrogations. Indeed, very few people are interrogated under the Obama administration. Instead, they're killed by drones. Obama has killed 1,500 people by drones in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and elsewhere.
How do you feel about that?
Sorry?
How do you feel about that?
What I think is interesting is that he has received much less criticism for that than Bush has received for his waterboarding of three people. Now, waterboarding is deeply unpleasant. Some define it as torture. The U.S. Justice Department said it was not torture at that time. It's a matter of argument. But it's certainly not such a final solution or a termination with extreme prejudice, as was the term that was used in Vietnam, as is drone killing. And the drones have undoubtedly killed a lot of very, very bad people who were plotting to kill American and other civilians, and also Muslim civilians, one should add, because most of the victims of al-Qaeda around the world have been Muslims. Hundreds of thousands of Muslims have been killed in al-Qaeda's vicious nihilistic search for power. But I don't object to the drones, but I think it's the legality of them is a matter of question and it's a matter of debate. What I'm interested in is that Obama has been able to carry out his drone policy very effectively without very much criticism.
David in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with William Shawcross. Hello.
Hello. I think it's outrageous to compare the secret, cynical trials at Guantanamo, which, A, have scarcely taken place. There have been, only a couple of trials brought to their conclusion, with the rules continually changing, designed to make it impossible for the accused to defend themselves, and with the proviso that the accused, in many cases, will nevertheless be kept in jail forever, or at least until the alleged end of a war on terror, whether or not they're found guilty. I mean, and it also depends, as so many of these things do, on whether you agree that there is a war in progress, and whether there has, in other words, been crimes against the peace of the world. I mean, this was a gigantic occasion at the end of which the Nazis had conquered and defeated the Western world. They had executed people by, deliberately by the million. Al-Qaeda would like to do that. So would a lot of people. But they can't and they haven't. So
these should be just seen, you're saying, as individual crimes.
Yes, this is crime. And even if it isn't crime, even if it were a war, it would not be a war against anybody who's done any, who's engaged in the kinds of crimes of aggression and crimes against humanity on the scale that the Nazis did, nor could they ever.
Thank you for your call. William Shawcross, go ahead and respond.
I think I said that the scale is completely different. I quite agree with that. It's not true, as you allege, that the trials in Guantanamo are secret. It is true that they've taken a very long time to be put on. That's partly because of the arguments that have taken place in Washington about their legality and congressional acts in 2006 and 2009, refining the process all the time. The trials are open. There's one trial already taking place, or the pre-trial proceedings of a man called Nashiri, who is the mastermind of the al-Qaeda plotters who blew up the USS Cole in Aden Harbor in the year 2000 with the death of 19 U.S. sailors, I think. And that is happening now. And anyone who's interested in seeing that trial can go to Fort Meade and look at it. And very few people are going to Fort Meade to look at it, but they can do so. It's being reported by the press. The press are there in Guantanamo and the press are there in Fort Meade, watching a closed-circuit link. And it's as open as possible. And the U.S. government has appointed a very distinguished man, General Mark Martins, who's a military lawyer who served in Iraq and Afghanistan with the rule of law campaigns in both countries. He is now the chief U.S. military prosecutor, so he's the direct successor of Robert Jackson. And he has made it explicit that he intends to run these trials as openly as possible and with the defendants having basically all the same rights that they would have in civilian courts in the United States. And I think he's a very fine man, and people who are working with him are trying to do to bring justice in the best possible and most open way in very difficult circumstances.
I'm curious to get your take on the Iraq war today. You and I have never spoken before, but I can hear that you're a thoughtful person who is willing to change your position based on evidence as you see it. And so you went from writing critically about the Vietnam War while it was taking place to being aghast at the consequences of leaving because of the slaughters that took place afterwards. What about Iraq, which, whether you supported it or not at the beginning, the result seems to be that tens or hundreds of thousands of Iraqi civilians were killed in pursuit not just of WMDs that didn't exist, but the rationale from President Bush, as I think you'll agree, was that it was a preventive war because someday Saddam Hussein might hypothetically share WMDs with terrorists. And in pursuit of that, we wound up with tens or hundreds of thousands of dead Iraqi civilians.
Well, you're absolutely correct that that the consequences of the overthrow of Saddam have been horrific for Iraqi civilians in particular. And you're right that over 100,000 civilians have died. There's a very good organization called IraqBodyCount.com, which I think is the most reliable of those trying to keep tally. It has to be said that the vast majority, probably 90% or more, of those people who have died have been killed not by the U.S., by the U.S. Army or by U.S. soldiers, but by other Muslims. And it's the horrific internecine fighting between Sunni and Shia that has led to the deaths of so many people. And
war unleashed that process. The invasion unleashed that process.
Yes, the invasion lifted the lid off the pressure cooker, if you like, rather like the fall of Tito did in Yugoslavia, the death of Tito did in Yugoslavia, if you like. And rather, as is happening throughout the Arab world now, most terrifyingly, I suspect, in Syria, but also in Egypt. But Syria is the one to watch in terms of Sunni-Shia internecine hatred, and those are problems which are not the fault of the United States. However, you're absolutely right that the United States mismanaged the aftermath of the war. There's no question about that. I have rather sort of taken my own, been guided by two or three Iraqi, which is a very small number of people, obviously, Iraqi friends who were exiled in London and couldn't go back under Saddam Hussein because they would have been killed by him. And they have been back in Iraq ever since. And one of them, a woman, has set up women's organizations. She was junior minister, deputy minister of culture in one of the post-Saddam governments. And she's involved in politics all the time now. And she sometimes despairs of what has happened. And she does say that the U.S., the way in which the U.S. sort of created or helped the, tried to create a governing system in Iraq post-Saddam was badly done. There's no question, no one denies that, and it's tragic. She does still say, however, unless Saddam had been overthrown, we could never have had hope. I still believe we can create a better system than we could ever have dreamt of having under Saddam.
We're almost out of time. My guest is William Shawcross, brilliant British journalist who has written Justice and the Enemy, Nuremberg 9/11, and the Trial of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. And he is the son of Sir Hartley Shawcross, who was the chief British prosecutor at the Nuremberg post-World War II trials. And I want to play a short clip that you led us to from your father, from his closing statement at Nuremberg.
Liberty, love, understanding comes to this court and cries, "These are our laws. Let them prevail."
He cited understanding. He cited love at the end of the Nuremberg trials. I was so struck by that when I heard it for the first time this morning. So lofty, so Martin Luther King-like, referencing love in the context of a battle for justice. Not the language of today's prosecution, I don't think. Not the language of vigilance that we would hear, and vigilance alone that we might hear from a Dick Cheney or John Bolton, if you will.
Well, you're right. It is a remarkable speech, and I used to listen to it as a child, as I mentioned earlier, and it moved me immensely. And his choice of words is surprising and very, very touching. I think, as I say, think not about John Bolton in this context, but who I don't wish to criticize because I think he has some very interesting views, but I think about General Mark Martins, and he made some very interesting speeches in New York recently, both to the American Bar Association and to the New York Bar Association in the last 3 weeks, about his determination to produce open justice and real justice for those whom he will be prosecuting in Guantanamo. And I think he is a very able and dedicated public servant of the United States. And I have immense admiration for public servants of the United States. The United States is, I think, the greatest democracy the world has ever seen. And we in Europe depend upon it. It's been our protective umbrella. And at the time of Nuremberg, the only human rights organization, the greatest human rights organization in the world, was the U.S. Army. And that may sound a bizarre thing to say, but I believe it has been true since the Second World War. The U.S. Army and American blood and treasure has liberated millions of people throughout the 20th century. And I feel that it's a truth that is not often enough recognized in Europe.
William Shawcross, his new book, Justice and the Enemy, Nuremberg 9/11, and the Trial of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. I enjoyed our conversation. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. So how do you teach controversies in history like these? How do you teach them in the classroom? We'll talk about that in a minute.